Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for the Technology Report and This is America, coming up after As It Is.
Hello, and welcome to As It Is from VOA Learning English. I'm Christopher Cruz in Washington. Today on the program, we report on the world's billionaires. We will hear from the author of a new book about the super rich and the influence they have on policies and politics.
What I wanted to do was just kind of do a serious analysis of billionaires in terms of who they are, how they got their money.
We look at the influence of the world's super rich on society. Today on As It Is from VOA. The world's super rich are the subject of a new book called Billionaires: Reflections on the Upper Crust. In American English, the term upper crust describes people who belong to the highest social class. Members of this class are not always wealthy, but often are. Darryl West wrote the new book. Mr. West is the director of governance studies at the Brookings Institution, a policy group based in Washington, D.C. In the book, he examines the influence of billionaires on politics, not-for-profit organizations, and the rest of society. Mr. West uses information from Forbes magazine's list of the world's more than 1,600 billionaires. They control more than $6 trillion in wealth. Darryl West says he wrote the book because he wanted to learn more about rich people.
What I wanted to do was just kind of do a serious analysis of billionaires in terms of who they are, how they got their money, how they're using their money, and also just what they're like personally. Because I think many people are just curious about these individuals. Who are they? What motivates them? And so I wanted to kind of answer some of those questions to the best extent that I could.
Darryl West examined political spending by American billionaires and their use of nonprofit organizations to reach their goals. He says billionaires often donate money to candidates seeking public office. He says they are also increasingly paying for campaigns aimed at forcing changes in policy. Mr. West says he found that in the United States, billionaires are becoming more active on the state or local level. He thinks that is because American media are paying less attention to state and local lawmakers than they once did. American billionaires spend tens or hundreds of millions of dollars in support of political campaigns. Some own media companies and use them to influence issues, candidates, and office holders. They often use their power in secret to gain special treatment for their interests. Mr. West says he is worried about this combination of wealth and secrecy. He believes it affects how governments operate and may limit social and economic opportunity. But billionaires are not always successful in their efforts to influence politics. Many wealthy Americans supported former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney in the U.S. presidential election 2 years ago. But Mr. Romney lost to President Barack Obama. Some billionaires have been supporting immigration reform and gun control, but they have not been successful in persuading Congress to change the laws governing those issues. Some billionaires have attempted to change the country's education system. Marshall Tuck was a candidate for the top education position in California. He received campaign donations from a number of billionaires who support reforms in education. The group included Michael Bloomberg, the former mayor of New York City. But earlier this month, Mr. Tuck lost in his effort to become California's superintendent of education. As Mr. West notes, money does not always equal political power. However, Mr. Bloomberg made donations to more successful political campaigns. He reportedly supported 5 winning candidates in governor's races. Most of the donations went to Democratic Party candidates or causes, but some of his money went to Republicans. Darrell West says billionaires use their money and power in other ways. He says their money is used to block people they do not like from being named to government positions. He says they can also use their influence to stop state or national legislatures from approving bills. He says billionaires have sought political office in several countries. They include France, Georgia, India, Italy, Russia, Thailand, and Ukraine. But writer William Lind believes that American billionaires are not as powerful as one might think. Mr. Lind is a fellow at the New America Foundation. He recently wrote about billionaires for Politico magazine. He says American billionaires have successfully influenced only a few social policies. He says they have failed in their attempts to reform America's immigration policy. He says billionaires have not succeeded at forcing changes to government programs set up to help older Americans and pay for their health care. And they have not been able to change the education system in the way they want.
I think the idea that the rich get their policy preferences without any significant opposition, that's simply not the case. There are issues where wealthy people do get their way, and those tend to be issues where the public is inattentive or doesn't have strong views.
William Lind says politicians in democratic countries often like to please people who give them money for their campaigns, especially rich donors. But he says an office holder may act differently if he or she believes that supporting a position will lead to his or her removal from office. Then, he says, office holders will do what they believe voters want them to do, even if it angers their wealthy supporters.
Voters still count. They make a difference. The voters, actually, they do have their own views. In a way, this narrative that the rich own all the politicians and brainwash all of the people to vote against their interest, it shows not only a lack of acknowledgement of the extent to which voters still have independent power, but it shows a kind of a contempt for the intelligence of voters. It assumes they're just easily brainwashed by advertisements bought by rich people.
Mr. Lind says billionaires are successful in reaching their goals on tax issues because they are organized, and they donate to the re-election campaigns for members of Congress. But he says billionaires do not always win in the United States. He says this is especially true on issues that voters care about and on which they take positions that are different from those of the wealthy. Darrell West says billionaires have a lot of power, but he agrees with William Lind that people in democracies also have power, helped by the news media. He says the more billionaires there are in a country, the less power each one has. That's our program for today. I'm Christopher Cruz, reporting from VOA Learning English Headquarters in Washington.
The Technology Report is next, followed by This is America. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Technology Report. Last year, a typhoon seriously damaged Leyte Island in the Philippines. More than 7,300 people died or are missing. 4 million Filipinos lost their homes, and many of them lost their incomes. Many fishermen are among them. They lost their wooden boats. Without them, they had no way to make money. The fishermen used boats called bancas. These boats were made from wood taken from the island's forests. But the forests were damaged by the powerful storm, making it difficult to quickly rebuild the boats. So a large non-governmental environmental protection group is helping the fishermen rebuild their boats using a material made of glass and plastic. The material is called fiberglass. The group says fiberglass lasts longer than the wood and plywood materials the fishermen have traditionally used to build their boats. Patrick Vincent Coe manages the Bancas rebuilding project for the WWF. He and his employees are teaching fishermen how to build boats with fiberglass.
We feel that this is simply the next step forward, both out of necessity and out of practicality, to use fiberglass rather than wood and plywood. And also something that is essentially more ecologically sound.
Ramon Binamira is a boat building expert. He says many of the fishermen were worried about using fiberglass to build boats. He says they asked many questions.
Is it strong enough? Will it be able to take the day-to-day abuse that the traditional boats have proven to be capable of taking?
The fishermen tested the fiberglass bancas with a heavy tool called a sledgehammer. The fishermen used it to hit the sides of the fiberglass boats to see if the new boats were as strong as their wooden boats. Norberto Della Torre is a 78-year-old fisherman. He says he was surprised by the strength of the fiberglass bancas. Mr. Della Torre says the fiberglass boats are durable. He says they are stronger in water than wooden boats. And he notes wooden boats get dirty easily. The new fiberglass bancas are now being used only for small-scale fishing. But the World Wildlife Fund hopes the new boat-building skills that fishermen are learning will help them design and create larger fiberglass boats. The WWF says the technology will help them better prepare for climate change and reduce the need for wood from forests damaged by Typhoon Haiyan. And that's the VOA Learning English Technology Report. For more technology stories, go to our website, learningenglish.voanews.com. Welcome to This is America from VOA Learning English. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Catherine Cole. Today, we visit a Southern California street that leads back hundreds of years.
The family stepped off a train at Union Station in Los Angeles. The mother looked around in the bright California sunshine and shook her head. "Where are we?" she asked. "I thought this was supposed to be downtown, the center of the city." The woman had expected to be completely surrounded by huge office buildings, but instead, she and her family felt as if they had somehow landed in another time. Their train ride had led them to the oldest part of downtown Los Angeles. The visitors had stepped back through centuries of history. They stood near the birthplace of Los Angeles, now the second largest city in the United States. They were close to where settlers and a few soldiers from Spain first set up the city in 1781. The settlers had left a nearby Roman Catholic religious center called Mission San Gabriel Archangel. They wanted to set up a community on the edges of the river, then known as Pocitucula.
Today, the place where the settlers started new lives is part of the El Pueblo de Los Angeles Historical Monument. The word monument sometimes makes people think of a traditional statue, perhaps a man riding a horse. But this monument includes historic homes, museums, and other buildings, parks, marketplaces, plazas, and many artworks. It has places to rest, eat, play, and places to think about what life was once like here. A marketplace and community event center called Olvera Street form a lively part of the historical monument.
La placita Olvera aquí es.
Chances are it is busy on Olvera Street today, but then energetic activity goes on here most of the time. People buy and sell things. Some people take lots of pictures. They stop for drinks, coffee, and meals. And nearly every day, mariachi bands fill the air with song and music from the Spanish-speaking world. And you hear many other languages spoken as well.
Millions of tourists pass each year among Olvera Street's puestos, or small businesses. They buy everything from imported leather goods to big hats, from dresses to shoes, from musical instruments to puppets hanging from strings. Olvera Street marks the heritage and the continuing relationship of the movie and television industry of Hollywood, a Los Angeles neighborhood, and nearby Burbank. Parts of movies and television shows are often filmed along Olvera Street and in the neighboring plaza. Long ago, silent film star Charlie Chaplin rescued child actor Jackie Coogan from a threatening welfare office in the 1923 movie The Kid. A 1952 film called The Ring told about a Mexican-American prize fighter struggling to gain a better life. And Danny Glover and Mel Gibson ran toward the plaza in the 1992 film Lethal Weapon 3. More recently, Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt danced there in the 2005 movie Mr. and Mrs. Smith. They danced in the center, or courtyard, of the Francisco Avila Adobe Historic Home. The building is said to be the oldest structure made of the material adobe in Los Angeles. A man named Francisco Avila had the home built in 1818.
Olvera Street is more than a tourist center and a movie set. It also has been used to mark or celebrate special events. The blessing of the animals is a good example. During the ceremony, people present their animals to a religious leader who offers thanks for the creatures. Thousands of people bring cows, birds, cats, dogs, horses, and other animals for the ceremony. Among the other animals are ferrets, lizards, llamas, ponies, and rabbits.
Christopher Espinoza works as general manager of the El Pueblo de Los Angeles Historical Monument. He says his favorite event is All Souls Day, the Day of the Dead. In Spanish, it is called El Día de los Muertos.
It's like the Mexican version of Halloween, and the main day lands on All Souls Day, a time period where traditionally you respect the people who have passed.
Mr. Espinoza described some of the event's many activities on Olvera Street.
And there's altars with beautiful marigolds. And then there's like a procession that occurs every day on Olvera Street and into the plaza. And every night there's dancing. And each day it builds bigger and bigger and bigger into the final day, the Dia de los Muertos. And that day there's this beautiful dance and the place is jam-packed.
Olvera Street probably would not have existed without huge effort. That is especially true of the volunteer work and influence of a woman named Christine Sterling. By the 1920s, large numbers of immigrants had arrived in California and other parts of the United States. The Avila Adobe and other historic buildings had fallen into poor condition. Ms. Sterling loved both history and Los Angeles. She heard that the oldest adobe structure in the city was threatened with destruction, and she started a campaign to save it.
People who wanted to rescue the Avila House donated money to repair and restore it. But not enough was raised. In 1928, the city government approved orders to condemn the home. But Mrs. Sterling followed with a note of her own. She accused officials of not caring about the city's past. Public opinion arose against destroying the old building. She and many in the public supported the return of the Avila Adobe and other places along Olvera Street to their former appearance. Ms. Sterling appealed to Harry Chandler for help. He was publisher of the Los Angeles Times newspaper during that period. She described her dream of a colorful marketplace and cultural center to Chandler. Chandler's newspaper aided her campaign, and he invited businessmen to fundraising meals. Harry Chandler was a powerful man. Other powerful people came to the expensive meals. With their help and that of others, the goal was reached.
Hasta que muera.
On Easter Sunday, 1930, the dream of Ms. Sterling and many people from that neighborhood came true. Olvera Street opened with the name Paseo de Los Angeles. Visitors immediately made the area a success. Neighborhood people called it Olvera Street, the street's postal office name. It honored Agustin Olvera. he became the first county judge in the new county of Los Angeles in 1850. Ms. Sterling also helped people with special skills find a place to demonstrate those skills. For example, in the 1920s, she visited Tijuana, Mexico. While there, she saw skilled handmade craft work by the father of a present Olvera Street businessman. She liked what she saw and invited the craftsman to work in Los Angeles, but he didn't take the invitation seriously.
Jesus Hernandez is the son of that man. He tells the story.
She told him, I'm going to ask you to come to Olvera Street in Los Angeles. And my father said, yeah, whatever. He was very young. He was probably mid-20s.
Happily for the father and for Olvera Street, the man later received another invitation. His son remembers that time he accepted. Jesus Hernandez has a business on Olvera Street, just as his father did. He has operated the import store for many years. He says he sells everything.
Not that I'm getting rich, but this is a tradition. This is what they taught me. This is what does. This is the only thing I know how to do.
A stone's throw from the street is the Italian Museum of Los Angeles, home to a mural called America Tropical. The Mexican artist David Alfaro Siqueiros created the painting on an upper-level outdoor wall overlooking Olvera Street. It is the only surviving public mural by Siqueiros in the U.S. that remains where it was painted. Some experts say Siqueiros was a major Mexican artist of the 20th century. Some call him the father of the Los Angeles mural movement. Yet America Tropical was painted over and nearly destroyed. For many years, it was forgotten.
The mural shows a poor Mexican Indian tied onto a cross. An eagle above the Indian looks threatening. Critics said the mural accuses the U.S. of oppressing poor people. To many people in Los Angeles, it was an unwelcome sight. But over the years, defenders recognized the mural's importance. They included experts from the Getty Conservation Institute. The institute formed a partnership with the city. Thanks to a project costing millions of dollars, the painting has been brought as close as possible to its earliest condition. People can study the mural, its artist, and the methods experts used to save it in the America Tropical Interpretive Center. A special platform, a raised structure, provides visitors with a good look at the painting. They enter the platform through Sepulveda House in Olvera Street.
The history of Siqueiros' work is one of the many stories told on Olvera Street. It is a place of memories and images of America's second largest city during the years Los Angeles invented itself.
This program was written by Geralyn Watson. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Catherine Cole. Join us again next week for another This is America from VOA Learning English.